Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs, chapter number 2. And we're going to begin in verse number 8 today. Remember, I believe that this is an opera dedicated to Solomon, not about Solomon, but dedicated to Solomon during the early good years of his reign in the prosperous and peaceful period of his kingdom. And it is a celebration of romantic love. I don't believe there's any need to spiritualize it. In fact, I think it's a little bit uncomfortable, given some of their very sexually explicit parts of it, to spiritualize it. Instead, I believe it's just a reminder, not unlike Hebrews chapter 13, which says that the marriage is to be honored among all, and the wedding bed or the marriage bed is completely undefiled. The sexual relationship between a husband and a wife is to be celebrated. It was part of the original creation. God designed us as sexual beings. He invented marriage before the fall came into existence. It was to be one man with one woman for eternity to begin with, but eventually, when sin and death came into the world, it became for a lifetime. So I think we should just look at this book as a celebration of that blossoming relationship and how it's not just simply passion, physical passion. It also results in this bonding of relationship between a man and a woman, making them best of friends. And so, so far in the first scene, we saw that the couple is working in the kingdom of Solomon, but getting moments out in the country where they can spend time together and enjoy each other's company and just kind of relax. I mean, the last thing we saw was her reclining with her head on his left forearm and him kind of propped up over her, caressing her with his right hand and letting her go to sleep and have a nice peaceful nap. And so that brings us to scene number 2, which I believe takes place at least a year later in the springtime, when she finds out that he's back at the palace, back in town. And she's all excited that he's coming to see her and make a recommendation to her. So she begins by singing this, verse 8. Listen, my beloved. Behold, he's coming. He's climbing on the mountains. He's leaping on the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, he's standing behind her wall. He's looking through the windows. He's peering through the lattice. So she imagines him coming closer and closer, having arrived back and getting right up to the screen work, as we would say, and wanting to call into her this. Verse 10. My beloved responded and said to me, and then he begins singing, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. For behold, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. In the Middle East, in the Promised Land, the winter tends to be dreary and wet. Sometimes it's snowy in places, but a lot of time it's just nasty, wet rain, which is important to put the water back into the ground, but it's not very pleasant to live in. But the springtime arrives and the rains kind of dry up. And what happens next? Verse 12, the flowers have already appeared in the land. The time has arrived for the pruning, the figs. The voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened its figs, and the vines in blossom have given forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. So he's basically saying, the spring is fully here. Everything's come back to life, and it smells wonderful. It looks beautiful, just like you look beautiful. And I want you to come away with me somewhere so we can just spend some time together since we haven't seen each other for a while. So it's the excitement of of getting back together after time apart. And she's ready for this, and she sings back, "Oh, my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the secret place of the steep pathway, let me see your form. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your form is lovely." So she's got pet names for him. She calls him her dove, and pictures the dove, you know, up in the little rocky clefts singing. And so that's what she says. I want to look on you after I haven't seen you for a while. And I want to listen to you. I just love hearing your voice after all this time because it's so beautiful to my ears. And seeing you is so lovely to my eyes. And then the chorus, which, remember, is a group that kind of helps set the emotional tone, maybe set the scene a little bit from time to time. They sing something that feels weird to us at this juncture, but it's something that apparently the audience of this time period would have been familiar with. It sets the timing of the spring, when all the blossoms are opening up and the fruit is getting ready to be set. They sing, "Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards while our vineyards are in blossom." So when all of the vines began putting on their little blossoms and the fragrance went out, the little foxes, baby foxes, young foxes that are now being born and growing up, they start running through the vineyards attracted by this smell and the sweet taste of some of these blossoms that they can get to. And they're leaping up, and of course that's doing some damage to the plants. And so apparently what would happen is some of the workers would run out into the vineyards and chase away the foxes. And of course it became something that maybe the couples would do together to enjoy the springtime, but also to do a little bit of work. So maybe, just maybe, this couple has engaged in that sort of behavior together, and that's why the chorus is singing about it. Then the woman sings, "My beloved is mine, and I am his." They are definitely a couple now. You can tell that. "He pastures his flock among the lilies until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. Turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of Bether." Now, what is she talking about there? Well, he has to go out and do his work. He has to go take care of the animals of Solomon. So he's got to be away during the day, but each night he's back. And so she's looking forward to him coming back to where she's at each and every night. And she wants him to hurry to do that. Now, it's possible we have a shift of scene at chapter 3, verse 1, to maybe it might be a dream sequence. That's a possibility, where she is wanting to consummate this relationship. She wants to be married to this man. And so let's take this scene as a dream sequence where she's dreaming at night about her future desires. So she sings, "On my bed, night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him." So she's still single. She's sleeping in bed alone, night after night, but not wanting to be alone. She wants to be in bed with him. Verse 2, "I must arise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I did not find him." So I think if this is a dream sequence, she dreams that she gets up out of her bed and she goes out into the streets of Jerusalem, apparently, looking for him in the middle of the night. Now, Jerusalem is a well-populated city, and so it has activity going on at night. Up in the temple, there's going to be songs being sung and music being played all night long by the Levites. But down in the city proper, you've got people probably staying up at night doing work, and then people getting up very early in the morning to take care of work. And the watchmen are always out and about. Now, these watchmen, they are partly policemen, but also partly firemen, to make sure that fires don't break out in the middle of the night when most people are asleep and cause a lot of trouble. So in her perhaps dream sequence, she runs into a watchman. The watchman who makes the rounds in the city found me. And I said, "Have you seen him whom my soul loves?" So she's looking for her beloved. And so she asks the watchman as they come by, "Have you seen him? Where is he?" Now, verse 4, apparently they haven't seen him. "Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves, and I held on to him, and I would not let him go until I'd brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me." So again, I think this might be a dream sequence. So you know how dreams work. Sometimes you have this shift of scene that's very abrupt, where she grabs hold of her beloved and she takes him back to the home where she grew up. And she takes him into the house where mom is. And she wants him to be there with the family. And then the man comes in to the sequence. And it closes the sequence in almost the exact same way the previous scene closed. "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases." So again, it's that, shh, be quiet. Don't wake her up just yet. Let her enjoy her dreams. The next scene is one of the reasons a lot of people want to make this about Solomon, because Solomon is prominently displayed in this scene. But I want to explain to you in a little bit why I think this comes in close connection with the marriage of the young couple that we've been following. In this scene, it's the chorus alone that sings. And so they describe the scene for us. "What is this coming from the wilderness, like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant?" So sometimes when you see a traveling group coming from the distance, what you actually see is the dust coming up from their passage first. So that's kind of the columns of smoke. But this is not an ordinary scene. This is the scene of a very special entourage. And so the chorus imagines that all that cloud of smoke that's being lifted up is actually the perfumed cloud of myrrh and frankincense and all sorts of other spicy smells. Verse 7, "Behold, it's the traveling couch of Solomon, 60 men around it, of the mighty men of Israel. All of them are wielders of the sword, expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night." So this is the entourage of King Solomon. He's in his sedan chair, and he's surrounded by his bodyguard as they move through the night. Verse 9, "King Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the timber of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, and its seat of purple fabric, with its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem." And so it's a picture of this highly ornamented traveling throne, this traveling couch of King Solomon, which probably both the woman and the man have seen firsthand. Then the chorus sings, "Go forth, O daughters of Zion," that would be Jerusalem, "and gaze on King Solomon with the crown with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart." So King Solomon has been married many times by now. And those have been often very public ceremonies that people have been able to see, and they've been stricken by the pomp and circumstance of it, and they love it. My wife and I were living stationed in England whenever Prince Charles and Princess Diana were married. And it was a really big day and week and months leading up to that. All the pomp and circumstance that were involved in that. All royal weddings are just like that. And of course, everybody dreams of having their own wedding be almost as spectacular, at least a small portion as spectacular, as the great dream wedding of the royalty. And so that's why I think the chorus comes in here, is to describe one of those wedding entourages, and then it becoming kind of like the theme for the wedding of this couple. Now, theme weddings happen. Even in our culture today, people will get married with a theme of Star Wars, or they'll get married with a theme of parachuting. I mean, they'll jump out of an airplane together and have the preacher coming down with them, marrying them, because that's something they really love. Some people have animal theme weddings or book theme weddings. Some will have weddings that are themed to the season of the year. My wife and I went to a winter-themed wedding with a sleigh as one of the decorations, and there were twinkling lights everywhere and lots of fake snow put around in the auditorium and the lobby. That's just something people like to do because it adds to the beauty and the excitement of the moment. Well, cultures will sometimes do that based on royal weddings. I know in some Jewish weddings, you will see people being brought in on chairs as if they were a king or a queen. And they're put under a canopy like they're in a temple. And it's not just the Jewish culture, but other cultures will do very similar things. That on the day of the wedding, the couple is treated as if they're royalty. They have crowns put upon their heads and royal-looking robes put on their bodies. Because I think it all goes back to the very beginning of time when the very first wedding was designed by God. God made man and woman, Adam and Eve, for each other. And he gave them the world and said to them that they were going to rule over it, effectively as king and queen. And so in some fashion, each husband and wife are royalty, becoming the king and queen of their life and of their little domain. So my belief is that that little choral thing, that little scene, was to introduce the wedding of this couple. And they may have been dressed up and carried in on chairs in exactly this fashion to the wedding ceremony. But the next scene, which starts in chapter number 4, is the man sweet-talking his wife by describing his reaction to her body from the top of her head right on down. And this is one of those places where it gets very explicit in the language. And by the time we get to the end of this scene, which I don't think we'll get to it today, we will see the desire to be involved sexually as part of the honeymoon and the invitation to do so. From the woman. All right, so the man does an awful lot of singing in this scene. So Solomon, Song of Solomon or Song of Songs, chapter 4, verse number 1. The man sings, "How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are." And by the way, gentlemen, it is a good idea to take some pointers from this to let your wife, your sweetheart, know that you love the way she looks. And vice versa, you ladies, to let your husband know that you love the way that he looks. Because all of us want to be appreciated. Okay? So keep that in mind. So here we go. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. So he's said this before, that he thinks her eyes look like doves to him. And she's got a veil on, which would probably be transparent, and it's probably just across her nose and over to her ear area and hanging down. So eyes are very prominent because they're popping, because they're uncovered. So that's the first thing he mentions. Then he talks about her hair. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Now remember, he takes care of animals, she takes care of animals. And so one of the common sights they see would be goats coming down as a group, down these little goat trails on the side of a mountain, on the side of a hill. And goats of this time period tended to be black. And so you'd see this little ziggy-zaggy, twirly thing coming down the side of a hill. And so he says that her hair, the little tresses hanging down the side of her head, were like little goat trails. Now, we would probably find that as, well, that's kind of rude and insulting. But for her, that's sweet talking. Because what he's actually saying is, I love the way your hair looks. I love the blackness of it. I love the way it's twisting down on the side of your head. Verse number verse 2 continues. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shown hues which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins. Not one of them has lost her young. A lot of animal talk, because they work with animals, both of them. And so every year in the spring, they would shear the sheep and wash them up, and that would make them very bright white. And so what he's basically commenting on here is, you've got wonderfully white teeth. He can see them shining through her veil. And in a time period when they ate an awful lot of stone ground grain, teeth would break and chip over your lifetime, and in your later life, you would tend to lose a lot of your teeth. And so he's actually commenting not just simply on how white her teeth are, but the fact that she's got a full mouth of them. They're all there. I love your full smile, is what he's basically saying. Then, still commenting on her mouth, verse 3, your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. So she's probably put some lipstick on, and so her mouth is a very bright red underneath her veil. They're framing in her full set of teeth. And then your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. So her cheeks is what he's kind of got in mind here. She's either blushing naturally, or she's actually put some cosmetic on there and kind of rouged them up so that they're like the color of the inside of a pomegranate when you cut it open. And it's coming through the transparent veil that he can see. Now he keeps moving down her body. Chapter 4, verse 4. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones, on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the mighty men. So he comments on how beautiful her neck is, and the jewelry that she's wearing on her neck. It was not uncommon practice that a woman would take the dowry given to her by the man, as promised to her to marry her. Remember, a dowry was kind of life insurance or alimony in advance. And so she would take that dowry, which would be bits of metal, precious metal, and she would make a necklace out of it and wear it on the day of her wedding and also on every special day thereafter. So he's basically saying, I love your neck and how it's set off by all of that beautiful jewelry that's around it. It reminds me of the beauty of David's tower. tower with all of the shields shining in the sun. But he's not done, but we have to be for the day because of our time. Have a great weekend. See you on Monday.